Good day, and welcome to episode 25 of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. Our special guest today is Dr. Anne-Marie Zadlik, speaking about her experience as a frontline worker with the current pandemic and with the AIDS-HIV virus as well. I'll let our moderator, Dustin Brown, introduce her in a moment, but first Dustin asked me to preface our broadcast with a reference to an issue that became a challenge during the discussion. Dustin says there are many ways of interpreting global progress against poverty and other social ills. In this episode, you'll hear Dr. Zadlik bring up some statistics that we think deserve careful study. For example, she says that 2 billion people have been lifted out of extreme poverty and implies that this is a consequence of United Nations initiatives and global cooperation. Dustin challenged this notion later on in the episode, suggesting global poverty has grown and wealthy nations are largely to blame. We hope that our listeners will, of course, come to their own conclusions on this fundamental topic. Here's Dustin.
Today, our main guest, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Anne-Marie Zadlik. Anne-Marie is a doctor and an HIV/AIDS specialist, a founder and co-founder of multiple organizations, a winner of multiple awards, and now, maybe most recently, a bit of a social media star for her regular heartfelt messages of encouragement and education throughout the duration of the pandemic. She's going to be presenting to us today on a part of her life's work and how her experience organizing against the spread of HIV/AIDS gives her hope about COVID-19 and other health crises. With the Pfizer vaccine approved in Canada just yesterday and the Moderna vaccine likely to follow soon enough, I think this is great timing for us to hear from a medical professional. So welcome, Dr. Zadlik, and thank you so much for being here. I'm going to get your slides up, and you are free to start your talk as soon as you would like to.
Okay, so thanks, Dustin. I have to apologize because during the first part of your meeting, I was actually in on a public health meeting just for a few minutes. You can actually put Zoom on your phone and Zoom on your computer. So it's pertinent information that I think I can pass on to you guys. And this is just based on the risk in our community right now, COVID-19. I think it's important to go off topic for a bit. In the last week, the number of cases in Guelph has skyrocketed. About a month ago, our number of cases were increasing slowly, and that was because of an outbreak in a Mennonite community, but they have responded so well and are now in yellow. So the outbreak in North Wellington is well under control. Now we're seeing people gathering again and people getting out in public without wearing masks. So there are about 600 cases now in the COVID clinic every day, which is huge. And yesterday there were 68 positives. Our average over the last month have been 18. And in the summer we had stretches of no positive cases at all. So we're going into the red. That's really disappointing. We'll stay there for 28 days. That announcement will come today or tomorrow. And so I really want to encourage people, our community for the first time is much more dangerous than it was 2 months ago. And when you're going into the grocery store, when you're going into public spaces, now is the time to really adhere to public health guidelines. Get that mask on. I'm not telling people what to do, but I'm really nervous. Get the mask on. There are excellent double layer masks that have a slot that you can put a polypropylene layer into. I highly recommend them. They're as good as N95 masks, which are used by the intensivists in the ICU while they're intubating a COVID-19 patient. And just keep your distance. I have a patient yesterday who tested positive because she went for a walk 10 days ago with a friend outside. They weren't wearing masks. You don't have to wear masks outside. But every once in a while, their shoulders touched because they were talking and they're intimate with one another. And so COVID-19 was passed and now it's being passed into her family. So this is a nasty virus that's so highly transmissible. okay, my rant is over. Sorry, Dustin. So I've done this PowerPoint presentation probably a couple of times a week now for the last 6 weeks or so. And every day I have to go in and change it because things are changing so dramatically. I did not have time to go in and change it last night, but at the end of the presentation, I think it's important for me to kind of go through the slides fairly quickly and then leave it open to question and answer, because I think we need to have a discussion about the Pfizer vaccines, the vaccines in general, and what the next 6 months are going to look like, and just leave it open to question and answer. This was a slide that I wrote in October in preparation for a TED Talk that got canceled. I actually phoned the TED Talk people. The talk was due in February of 2020. I got the slides together in October. And I phoned the organizer and said, you got to cancel your talk because I think there's a pandemic out there. So unfortunately, the talk was canceled. But the slides, these are basically the slides that I put together. They're still very applicable. In working with HIV over the last 30 years, I saw my first HIV positive patient when I was 23 in 1987. Dalhousie Medical in Halifax. I just happened to be in the room when the first dose of the first HIV medication available in the country was given to the first patient. And it was like the room started to vibrate around me because I understand what those emotions were now, but back then I didn't. But I just knew that this was going to be where my career went to. I was mesmerized by this person and heartbroken for him because this patient was abandoned by his family, was dying of HIV, abandoned by his friends. Housekeeping wouldn't go into the room to clean his room, and his food trays were left outside. So as a very naive 23-year-old, I didn't know what all this meant. I don't think I knew what the word stigma was, but it enraged me at that point and it inspired me to go back to McMaster Medical School and learn as much as I could about HIV. And that was the start of a career that allowed me to work in HIV over a 30-year time period, during which we've come from this deadly disease that was highly stigmatized to a disease that is chronic and manageable. And in a few short years, 5 years to 10, we'll have a cure. And to understand what the world has done in the last 30 years to make HIV a chronic manageable disease required resources and incredible science and technology, incredible collaboration globally for that to take place. Thank God it did, because it provided a template for the world acting and science and technology responding to the pandemic, the COVID pandemic. Without that, COVID would be running amok in our communities, and we'd have no defense against it, which would be totally catastrophic. So what I'm going to prove to you, I probably don't need to. We're watching history being made. We're watching how the world has come together. I'm a very optimistic person. I don't want to talk about the negative stuff. We just need to see the positive stuff, because it's miraculous what's happening out there. I firmly believe that we have, as a race, have the ability and the capacity to solve all of our global issues. So this is a beautiful document. I just wanted to read the first part of this declaration. I think your group is very attuned to things like this, and you'll be inspired by it as well. In 2000, the World Health Organization had decided that it was impossible to treat people dying of HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria in resource-poor countries. And so they decided they weren't going to try. Just let these people die, which meant you were going to keep the divide between the rich and the poor and allow rich countries to thrive and allow poor countries to become failed states. A lot of people were not happy about that, thank goodness. And so in 2000, on September 8th, the United Nations held a general assembly called the United Nations Millennium Conference. And at that conference, they put together the United Nations Millennium Declaration. And from that came the Millennium Development Goals. And those are goals that have inspired me. I've thrown my life's work behind behind goal number 6, which is to combat HIV/AIDS. But this is a stunning document, and the what we've been able to accomplish as a result of this declaration and the goals being put into place is pretty amazing. So I'm just going to read, it won't take long. The United Nations General Assembly on September 8, 2000, from which we came the United Nations Millennium Declaration. We, heads of state and government, have gathered at United Nations headquarters in New York from September 6 to 8, 2000, at the dawn of a new millennium, to reaffirm our faith in the organization and its charter as indispensable foundations of a more peaceful, prosperous, and just world. We recognize that in addition to our separate responsibilities to our individual societies, we have collective responsibility to uphold the principles of human dignity, equality, and equity at a global level. As leaders, we have a duty, therefore, to all the world's people, especially the most vulnerable, and in particular, the children of the world to whom the future belongs. That always chokes me up. We reaffirm our commitment to the purposes and principles of the Charter of the United Nations, which have proved timeless and universal. Indeed, their relevance and capacity to inspire have increased as nations and peoples have become increasingly interconnected and interdependent. We are determined to establish a just and lasting peace all over the world in accordance with the purposes and principles of the Charter. We rededicate ourselves to support all efforts to uphold the sovereign equality of all states, respect for their territorial integrity and political independence, resolution of disputes by peaceful means, and in conformity with the principles of justice and international law. With a focus on respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms, respect for the equal rights of all without distinction to race, sex, language, religion, and to international cooperation in solving international problems of an economic, social, cultural, and humanitarian character. There's a little bit more of that declaration. I highly recommend to read the first part of it. From that declaration, they identified some values that they were going to adhere to. And I think that's something that every organization, every country, every province, every structure or organization needs to sit down and decide what their values are. And I think our values have plummeted, if you can say that. We've lost track of the values that make us strong people, that make us people of integrity, that make our nations, nations of integrity. So here are the values put forward by the United Nations conference. There were 150 countries at that conference: freedom, equality, solidarity, tolerance, respect for nature, shared responsibility. There you go. Okay, so from this conference and the United Nations Millennium Declaration in 2000 came 8 beautiful goals, the Millennium Development Goals. We had until 2015 to reach these goals, and after 2015, they put into place 17 Sustainable Development Goals, which are ongoing. I won't go through all of these goals, but what I'll do on the next slide is tell you, this is so important, I'll tell you what we accomplished as a result of falling behind in support of the Millennium Development Goals. It's so important that people understand what we're capable of when we work together. Next slide. Okay, the first one was to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. What a massive goal. Like, how audacious to set a goal like that. But in fact, the inequalities between countries are due to factors, and most of the time, actions of human beings historically, they can be corrected. What we did as a result of following and working towards this goal is we lifted 2 billion people out of extreme poverty, 2 billion people. The main way that we did that was put the infrastructure in place for electricity, because if you have electricity, you can study. If you can study, you can achieve a good education, and it's your education that will allow you to elevate yourself out of poverty and to elevate your community out of poverty. Electricity, that's all that was needed. Achieve universal primary education. These goals are interconnected and they work together as well. We increase the number of children in primary school from 57 million to 100 million. promote gender equality, empower women. This has been a huge force that's occurred in the last 20 years. Listen to the Me Too movement. 90% of countries now have more women in parliament than since 1995, and more women are in leadership. Reduce child mortality. So the under 5 child mortality rate remains high in resource poor countries. That's awful. The main entity, the main disease that a child under 5 dies of in the world is diarrhea. All that child needs is healthy drinking water. The second cause of death is pneumonia. We were able to reduce the number of children dying under 5 in half. Improve maternal health. Women all over the world still die in childbirth. You can still fill a jumbo jet of women, and each one counts for the number of women who die in childbirth every day in this world. The way that we conquered that and reduced that by half was by very simple measures. Harvard University put together a package that they rolled out into resource poor countries. In the package was a syringe that allowed someone to suck the mucus out of a baby's mouth when it was born, instructions as to how to grab the uterus, and an injection of a medication that caused the uterus to contract. So the main thing a mother dies of without medical care when she's delivering is a hemorrhage. And literally all you have to do, if you know where to search, is when the mother's had the baby, you have to grab the top of her uterus, sorry to gross anybody out, and squeeze it down. And that makes the uterus contract and stops bleeding. A very simple maneuver. We just needed to educate people on how to do that. And number 6, which is the one I went after and encouraged my community to follow me to try to achieve, is combat HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. This is the goal we succeeded the most at. Sorry for my grammar. There's been a 50% reduction in the number of new HIV infections, but there's been so much more since we reached that goal, which I'll go into some detail about. And then ensuring environmental stability. I won't go into number 7 and 8, but essentially those two goals are what we need to focus on now. Once we've conquered COVID-19, and we will, we need to throw all of our collective efforts, intelligence, resources, the intellectual property of the world behind climate change. And that will rise to the surface and be most important. And I'm very, very hopeful about what we can do about the climate. Next slide. Okay. What you're seeing is the number of people infected with HIV. That slide, I keep forgetting to change it, should say 2019. What we're seeing when you see those numbers coming up, that's the number of people infected with HIV in each of these countries, is the huge gap between the rich and the poor, rich countries and resource poor countries. All over the world, there's been a stable number of HIV infections. The incidence of the infections are coming down by a bit, but not as much as we'd like. But the huge number of people still infected in sub-Saharan Africa, 23 million. And World Health Organization in 2000 was going to say, well, there's nothing we can do. It's too complex a task. Let's just leave them alone. Thank God we didn't do that, because conquering HIV, which we've almost done, was a very complex problem. And the resources and talent we used to get there are now the resources and talents we're throwing behind COVID-19. It's amazing stuff. Next slide. Okay, so here's what we did with Millennium Development Goal number 6. So far, HIV has claimed the lives of 33 million people. There were an estimated 38 million people living with HIV at the end of 2019, so the disease is still spreading. In 1996, there were $250,000 available to treat HIV globally. By the time the MDGs were put into place, and because of 7 wealthy nations and Bill and Melinda Gates, the Global Fund for HIV/AIDS was created, and it is a $6 billion annual fund. And what is allowed is it has allowed antiretroviral treatment, strong, powerful medications, to be distributed to over 26 million people in resource poor countries. And the beauty of that is these medications are so powerful, they bring your viral load, the amount of virus that's replicating in your system, to undetectable levels. You can't find the virus in the bloodstream. It hides, though. We can't get to all of it. And when a person who is undetectable on good drugs, they cannot transmit. which means coordinate your efforts. Go into a small country like Lesotho, which has 2 million people, 250,000 infected with HIV. Test everyone, treat everyone, and AIDS is gone in that country. I'm reading this slide now. I used to read it and people would look at me like I had three heads, but we're watching right now why this is totally, totally possible. We're watching history unfold. This will be easy to do. And the messenger RNA vaccine technology, the HIV workers have been trying to create that vaccine for 30 years because HIV is an RNA vaccine. We're going to shift that technology and make a vaccine for HIV. So I'm not retiring until I'm 90. This is awesome. Next slide. Okay, so I'll quickly go through this. I'm watching my time, Justin. Oh, good. I'll just give you some more bright news about HIV. In 2007, when I first treated my first HIV patient in 1996, I had to give a complicated cocktail of drugs that they took three times a day. I like to give a tribute to the first six patients that I treated in Guelph. They were all young men in my age group. They were all homosexual. I loved them dearly. And they taught me so much. At that time, I was there to help them die. A couple of them, my initial group of seven, I was able to treat, but it was complex treatment. By 2007, the complicated drugs turned into one pill once a day. There are three drugs in that pill. By 2012, we proved that a person who's undetectable can't transmit, which is massive. By 2013, we showed that a person on HIV treatment can live a normal life expectancy. As a matter of fact, the life expectancy of an HIV positive person in this country, because they have to see their doctor every 3 months, is actually longer than a person without HIV, because I hammer them about their smoking and their weight loss and their exercise. By 2016, there are seven pills that are one pill once a day. And we believe that we're a short 5 to 10 years away from a cure. I'm not going to go into detail about how that is, but there is a new target set by the United Nations, which is the last point on that slide. Next slide. Okay, this is me when I was really, really young, and that was my hair color. Bracelet of Hope, I think most of you know about Bracelet of Hope. In 1990, I came to the community, started caring for seven of my lovely HIV patients. 2000, most of the physicians treating HIV left the community, and I was asked to take on more patients, which there was no way that I could do that. Someone encouraged me to start an HIV clinic. I said, there's no way I can do that either. But that friend got me invited to Queen's Park, didn't know where Queen's Park was, to an HIV clinic director's meeting. And at that meeting, part of the Ministry of Health, they encouraged me to start the process of developing an HIV clinic. We opened the first clinic in Guelph in 2005, the second clinic in 2010 in Waterloo. We've cared for about 700, 800 HIV positive patients over those years and delivered hundreds of babies that are HIV negative because their moms were put on treatment.
Interrupting briefly here to tell you that Anne-Marie had so much great stuff for us that we had to do a bit of a snip here so that we can make a transition from her excellent talk about HIV and switch into the more immediate pandemic issues. Here she is again.
We think the virus existed in China in November, which is kind of heartbreaking because the world did not know about that till January. What the Chinese scientists were able to do because of our advanced technologies was actually identify the genetic sequence of the virus. It's an RNA virus. That's its genetic material. And they did publicize that to the world, to the scientific community. They shared that genetic sequence. So by January, in most countries, they had the DNA PCR test already developed. So the nasopharyngeal swab that you get if you go to the COVID clinic, it existed very early on because of the genetic technology we have. Can you switch to the next slide, Dustin? This talks about antibody tests. As a matter of fact, at this morning's meeting, there's now a PanBio rapid test out there. It's an antibody test which you can purchase in Guelph. The warning we're giving is it's not a diagnostic test and it needs to be confirmed with a PCR test. So people need to be careful about using these rapid tests. This is a new development since the last time I gave these slides. COVID clinic opened in March. Fantastic community smart response, thanks to the Guelph Family Health team and Ross Kirkconnell in putting together this stunning clinic. Next slide. Oh, and I just have to say, Nicola Mercer has been an outstanding medical officer of health. She was the first to make masks mandatory under the Section 22 order in June. Most places have fallen into line with that. It's amazing to me that BC just put mandatory masks in place now, but our community has done very well because of that mandatory mask order. I think most people know the signs and symptoms of COVID-19. The one you need to be the most worried about: fever, cough, extreme pain, or extreme fatigue, muscle aches and pains, like a general flu. But what makes this one different is that in 40% of people, they've lost the sense of taste and smell. It's pretty remarkable. They've literally lost the sense of taste and smell. And that's because the virus goes to the respiratory cells at the back of the throat, infects them, kills them, and for a period of time, you lose your sense of taste and smell as a result. It does come back, but it's very slow. Next slide. Those are the vaccines. It's a terrible slide, but that's a list of the vaccines that are available. This is now an old slide. So the Pfizer vaccine, which is a messenger RNA vaccine, has been approved for use. Moderna is next, probably in the next couple of weeks. Moderna will be much more easy to distribute because it can be kept at fridge temperature. And Johnson & Johnson is quickly behind with a vaccine that is not a messenger RNA vaccine. It's a different vaccine, but its phase three results are showing a 95% effective rate as well. So just remarkable. People should not be afraid of vaccines because the technology that goes into making a vaccine, these technologies have been developed over the last 30 years. Scientists and researchers were waiting for the moment when they could do something with this technology. It takes billions of dollars to take a vaccine or any treatment through a phase one to a phase three trial. And every time you make it through phase one and on to phase two, you need to wait for permission to move forward and you need more billions of dollars. So it's a decade before a scientist or a scientific group can get enough money and have enough subjects to do research on. That's why previous vaccines took 10 years, not because of the technology and not because of, it's not being pushed because, and it may be dangerous. That's not it at all. We know these vaccines very well. I keep saying in my post, this vaccine was made for a time like this, but we understand this technology very, very well. The first vaccine was actually ready to go in February. So as soon as that genetic sequence was publicized to the world, it was put in place or discovered, mapped out by China, sent out to the rest of the world. Pfizer and Moderna had their vaccine ready in February. That's how the technology was there. It didn't take anything to put it together. And so from February to now is the time it took to put it through the phase three research trial and then to show that it's successful. And it's taken 2 months for Health Canada to approve it. Very safe vaccine, very safe. I think questions now, Dustin.
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate too. I want to make sure we have enough time to get through what everybody wants to go through. And I'm going to start with Councillor Ault. I see your hand up.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. I wanted to get in early because you had mentioned the RNA-based vaccines, and there have been some, I think, misguided fears on these as to what they might do, including one which is making the rounds right now, that it might have an impact on fertility and reproduction. But I was wondering if you could please explain the RNA foundation as being relatively inert and, from what I understand, resides muscularly. It actually deteriorates, if I'm correct. Is that correct? If you could just explain it, because it's It's incredible technology.
It's incredible technology. My son didn't go into medicine, went into organic chemistry. He recently moved to San Francisco during the wildfires to join Gilead. And so he's in a lab making the next generation of HIV medications, which I think is very ironic. So I've watched, I can't believe what these guys can do in the lab under electron microscopes with organisms that are 80 nanometers, which is how big the COVID virus is. So I have heard the infertility conspiracy. That's such a conspiracy. There is no way that a piece of messenger RNA that is tiny, tiny, tiny from a vaccine that, you're right, disintegrates in the muscle right away can get to anybody's fallopian tubes or ovaries to cause them to be. It's just not biologically possible. So essentially what we're doing is in the lab, they were the COVID-19 virus has RNA, a very long string of RNA, which is their genetic material. They've been able to isolate the messenger RNA, part of the RNA, that confers for making the spike protein on the surface of the virus. The spike protein is necessary for the virus to seek out a human cell, attach itself to the cell, and then allow itself to get into the cell. Virus can't survive unless it has a human host. When that virus gets into your cell, most commonly a respiratory cell at the back of your throat, it hijacks the cell's DNA. The cell can no longer do what it was designed to do. Now its new function is to make more virus. The cell dies, more viruses are entered into the bloodstream. So what they did was found the messenger RNA that confers for the production of the spike protein. That then goes into your body. The messenger RNA makes cells just locally start producing spike protein because that's what it makes your human cells do, just in the muscle. Then your immune system sees these spike proteins and says, that doesn't belong here. I'm going to make antibodies to it. And so antibodies go after those spike proteins and gobble them up. Then the number of antibodies go down, but they don't disappear. They're stored in the body. And they chew up all the spike protein that's at your arm where the injection was given. There's no more spike protein, so they stand by. But if you go near someone with COVID-19 and breathe in the virus and it goes into the back of your throat and infects a cell, before it can even get to the cell, those antibodies are called into action and they go after the spike protein and kill it. It sounds like such a simple series of steps, but it's very complicated science. Does that answer your question? I think, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much. It's so important to break down those misconceptions and fears. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Further on that note, there's a question that I got that said, you know, some people think that the mRNA approval process has been rushed. But they're saying that it's their understanding that this type of vaccine has been studied for 15-ish years, and that's something that people need to know more strongly about. And is that communication kind of like a priority for health professionals and public health?
So I put together two YouTube videos. This is something I never thought I'd be doing on the weekend that review that specific point. And I think I'm going to create another one that just talks about why the vaccine is safe. The messenger RNA vaccine technology, HIV was the first human virus found to have RNA in it. There were French researchers who stood up to say, this is RNA. This is before they had microscopes that could really tell and be clear on what they were seeing. A lot of those folks were lost their careers because it was blasphemous to say that a human cell could, or a virus could have RNA in it. But that's what it has. And so the technologies over the last 30 years have been focused on RNA. There are RNA virologists that have been in existence for 30 years who've been working on vaccines and medications using RNA to treat viruses. So it's actually 30 years. You can find the first researcher if you research her. I wish her name was expressed a lot more, but women tend to not be put in the forefront when they're leaders. years. Sorry to say that, but that's going to change too. So yes, it's been a technology that's been evolving for 30 years in an effort to find a vaccine for HIV.
Great. Now I'm just moving along in the questions that I'm seeing in the chat. We have from Morgan a question. How accurate is the antibody test for COVID?
Not very accurate. So the PanBio rapid test, I guess, can be purchased in Guelph. I'm not sure where it can be purchased. I'll have to ask Nicola Mercer where it's located. I've heard pharmacies. I'm not sure. I'll look that up this week. So the antibody test tests for your antibodies to the virus, which means you have to be far enough along in the infection to have developed an adequate antibody response for this test to pick up those antibodies. And from the day that you're infected, this virus is bizarre, you can be infected on a Friday and not show any symptoms until 5 or 6 days later. SARS, 13 or 17 years ago, you were symptomatic on day one. And so on day one, that means you had enough antibodies in your system when you were symptomatic for an antibody test to be positive. But if it takes 5 days before you develop symptoms, and then from the time you're symptomatic, maybe 4 or 5 days more before you have enough antibodies in your system, before your body's mounted that response. An antibody test, unless it's done 2 weeks after infection or 4 weeks after infection, is going to be negative. So you can presume that it's positive, that COVID-19 is there, but it has to be confirmed with the PCR test that's actually looking for the genetic material of the virus, not just the antibodies your body has made to fight it.
Okay, I'm seeing, okay, from Bill McClellan, if somebody, brackets like me, taking an immune suppressant like Imuran, is less able to develop antibodies. I think, Bill, the rest of your question is, is the vaccine going to be safe for somebody in your position?
So that's what we need to figure out. And it will take time to figure that out. I don't think the vaccine is contraindicated in people who are immunosuppressed. So in the years of experience I've had with my HIV patients who have who are assumed to be immunosuppressed, 6 or 7 years ago, I wasn't allowed to use any vaccines in them. And further research has shown that, no, they're safe to get all vaccines, maybe not so much the live vaccines, but we've even been giving my HIV patients the live vaccines. Live vaccines means you've actually taken a piece of the virus and made a vaccine out of it. These messenger RNA vaccines do not have any viral components in them at all. The RNA that they've identified and pulled out of the virus then was made synthetically in a lab. It is not the virus's RNA. So given that, it's highly unlikely that a person who's immunosuppressed will have a problem with the vaccine. But then the question is, will your body mount enough of an immune response if it's suppressed to protect you from COVID-19? So this is what I think is going to happen, but there's no answer to this yet. I think it's going to be available to everybody, even people who are immunosuppressed, and maybe especially people who are immunosuppressed. They may need more than 2 vaccines to show that they're immunosuppressed, and they should probably or will probably need to have antibody testing done to prove that they have seroconverted and responded to the vaccine. So that's how I think it's going to work. You're just going to be put in a special category, vaccinate, maybe vaccinate again, and then 2 months later, check for titers to see if your antibodies to COVID are present.
Okay, Bill, I hope that answers your question. I realized that Morgan actually had a follow-up to the previous question. So Morgan, if you want to come in and go for it.
Hi, thanks, Dustin. And just so everybody knows, that's Breezy Breakfast, or now called Rising Sign in behind. I came for breakfast this morning. Bev says hi. So my question was, actually, I believe that I contracted COVID-19 in Calgary in December. And then it came up just before, it was the Sunday before New Year's when I woke up with a sore throat. I was sick the entire month of January, had every symptom except for the loss of taste or smell. So my question was more someone like me that suspects they may have had the virus before it was really known. Is there an antibody test and how effective?
The antibody test is the antibody test. There won't be specific antibody tests, but so here's what might have happened to you. You had the illness, your body has produced antibodies to the virus. Those antibodies are now being stored and are ready to fight the virus again. We don't know how long you keep those antibodies. Do you keep them for 6 months, 8 months? Do you keep them for a year? Do you keep them for life? Will we all need a COVID vaccine every year like a flu shot? So it could be that if you had COVID, you no longer have antibodies that are detectable on a test. I would get the test just to be sure. I think it's about $100 and some odd. But if you're curious, it's not available covered by the government yet because the government, we cannot see its place yet and its value yet. And it's not very sensitive and specific. So why back it? But you could check. I would, if you don't have antibodies, if that test tells you you're antibody negative, that doesn't mean you didn't have COVID. And get immunized anyway. Yeah.
Because we got some great questions that I think need to be brought forward. So this one from Robert Morris says, we cannot visit an elderly relative in the UK who is alone at home with no family. I understand Canada will get vaccines from the UK, Germany, and USA. What are your thoughts on the schedule for distribution and process to vaccinate the population, both in high-level locations like Toronto, as well as places like Guelph?
So can you ask that again, just the last part, the actual question?
Yeah, what are your thoughts on the schedule for distribution and process to vaccinate the population?
Okay, so Monday night, we're holding our fourth webinar. These webinars are so much fun, and we bring Nicola Mercer was on the last one. Marva Wisdom helps us moderate. And on Monday night, Linda Hassenfrass is on the webinar. When we asked her, I kind of thought, well, she's a business person, but we need medical folks. And in fact, she's on the provincial task force for the distribution of the vaccine. So stay tuned if you want to hear more of that information. I'm not sure how much she can share, but I think this is just what I believe will happen because it's not known. There's 250,000 vaccines in the country right now. They're going to go to people in long-term care homes. There's going to be a struggle about how to get the vaccine to people who are bedridden because right now Pfizer doesn't want the vaccine to move from its distribution location where it's kept frozen to a nursing home. I think we'll work that out, but we have to show Pfizer, and it's Pfizer that makes these decisions because it's their vaccine. We have to show Pfizer how we can safely get those vaccines off the truck and to a nursing home and keep it stable. Because if you're giving vaccine that's no longer stable, it won't be effective, and that will look really bad for Pfizer, right? So, but Moderna is coming on board, and I think Pfizer will fade a bit because Moderna, I can go into a nursing home and immunize all my patients as long as I've got a freezer bag, right? Like a cold bag. So we'll do our long-term care folks first. We'll protect them. That is so important. And most likely the personal support workers and nurses that take care of them. We are going to see things go so fast that you will be dizzy. The government cannot tell you how things are going to work because they don't quite know yet. But this government has purchased vaccine from 8 companies, not over 190 million doses. They were so smart. They were first in line. You don't need no political things. I'm just judging what they've done. It's remarkable. And so as soon as vaccines like the Moderna is approved for use, bam, there's going to be 8 million vaccines in the country. As soon as Johnson & Johnson comes on board, bam, there's going to be 20 million vaccines in the country. So Hilliard and our lovely major general in Ontario, what's his name? Fernin or something like that. These guys are getting ready for a massive distribution. They will be ready. You're going to see this happen so fast. I think that by March, most people above the age of 65, 70 will be immunized. And then between March and August, we'll start immunizing younger and younger age groups.
Thank you. I think that's consistent with what I've seen coming out of news from the BC government. So I can support that. Okay. I think the last kind of, you know, specific medical question is from Bill Hewlett, and it was, how important are the 3-layer masks and where can we get them in Guelph?
Just so happens. This is with me all the time. Okay, this is from Hides and Hands, this mask. Hides and Hands is a local company outside of Rockwood. You can look them up online. She delivered me, the owner delivered me some masks way back in March, and I was, or May, and I was amazed at their quality. So these are high quality cotton, double layer masks. Other organizations are making good masks too. I just haven't kept track of who. It needs to be a 600 thread count cotton, not below that. Thin cotton won't work. 2 layers of 600 thread count. And then she has created an opening in the side of the mask. And inside this mask is a polypropylene layer. This is very thin, but it's a tight weave. So when you take your 2-layer mask and you put the polypropylene layer in between, it is as effective as an N95, meaning it can keep 95% of particles out. I don't think we would wear these pretty masks in the ICU. And the problem with them might be how they fit, because an N95 mask used by an intensivist who's about to intubate a patient has been pre-fitted to his face, so there is no air coming out. They're awful. I hate wearing them. It's like having a suction cup on your face all day. But by all intents and purposes, when you aren't intubating a person who has COVID, these are as good as an N95, very comfortable to wear. I can't figure out the ears. They bother me. But do put these on, especially now that the numbers, 68 positive cases in Guelph yesterday. That's high. And behind those 68 cases, where you should add about 1,000 more. Of asymptomatic people or people who may have come in contact with that group, which means it's now everywhere. Put the mask on, stay 6 feet apart. You can't gather for Christmas. Let's all cheer each other with champagne over Zoom and look forward to a fabulous celebration in 2021.
Okay, two more quick medical questions. One from Joanna McMaster. When somebody has had COVID, can they still transmit and how long do they have immunity for? And the other was, just came in from Tanya, where do you get the polypropylene layer of the mask? So whichever one you want to address first.
I'll answer the second one because I was so happy to hear that Joanna was on that I just lost track of her question. So polypropylene can be purchased at Men's Lens Mill Store. And I hear that Fabricland or other craft stores also have it. You can get it at Hides and Hands. She has a basket at the entrance of her store that has packages of five of these in one package. That's a bit expensive. It's the cheapest is to buy it from Lens Mill Store and make it into the right size. You can also get them on Amazon, but I don't want to purchase from Amazon at all this year, maybe never again. When I've looked at the ones on Amazon, because I can't touch them, I don't know if they're good quality. And you buy from Amazon, and I think it just goes to a dump when you return it. Like, this is bad business to have things. I don't know. I'm against Amazon right now. I think it's bad for the environment. I think it's bad for people. We need to shift completely to buying local, like completely. Buy it in Guelph, buy it where you live, support local. Sorry, that's totally off topic. What was Joanna's question?
It was, when someone has had COVID, can they still transmit and how long do they have immunity for?
When someone has had COVID and their symptoms are gone, that's probably what the question is. So you can have no symptoms at all with COVID. That's dangerous for spread. You can have lots of symptoms, but it's thought that by day 10, you are no longer infectious. Not day 14. So the quarantine time will likely change from 14 days to 10. And we're also telling people that... actually, I won't say that because that's a little bit confusing. So you're probably not infectious day 10, but we ask people to be careful till the 2-week mark. They can head back to work wearing a mask at day 10. And how long are we immune? No clue. No clue. We initially thought that there was only short-term immunity. New trials are showing, this immunity goes on for a lot longer. And the vaccine causes you to mount a very, very significant immune response. If I'm walking by somebody who has COVID-19 and I'm 4 feet away and they cough, I may just get a few particles in the back of my throat. My immune system kills most of them. Some of it gets in. I have a bit of a cold. My viral load is very low. I didn't get much virus, right? I didn't get a huge inoculum when that person walked by me. So I may not have triggered my immune system to produce antibodies long-term. If I get very, very sick, most likely I've got immunity that will last longer. But the mRNA vaccines, we believe, have the ability to confer immunity for a very long time. But it's only been on the planet for a year, so we can't know if that's actually true. We can't know about long-term side effects, and we can't know about how long we're immune for.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll switch gears a little bit, and I'm going to be a little bit mean and save, I guess, the hardest questions for the end. And these are huge questions. We're not going to be able to, you know, discuss them to the extent that they merit, just because of time. But I think we'll start with kind of the global level and then kind of work our way down to more local political issues. So globally, I mean, I have a background in international development studies, so I'm quite familiar with the MDGs and the even the sustainable development goals as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm aware that there are a lot of criticisms over how the World Bank and UN define what extreme and absolute poverty is, mm-hmm. at $1.90 US dollar equivalent per day. And, you know, there was an outgoing UN special rapporteur who just in July published a report saying that if that level were set at $5.50 instead, which is closer to what, you know, a reasonable standard of living would be,
then
the number of people in absolute poverty will have then only gone down by 100 million from 3.5 billion to 3.4 billion.
Yep.
So I think it demonstrates that claims of widespread success globally in eradicating extreme poverty needs to be tempered with, really the level at which people's
perspective. Yeah. So the two billion lifted out of poverty, that's extreme poverty, not poverty. And extreme poverty is identified as living on less than a dollar a day. So really, no one should be living on less than a dollar a day, certainly not 2 billion people. And yes, it was probably easier to lift people in extreme poverty out of poverty. Now we have to focus on, come on, guys, there should not be this kind of gap. There shouldn't be people suffering like this in the world. There's no need for it. We are richer than we've ever been. We have more resources than we've ever been. There just has to be the will and most people focused on doing it, leadership that is focused on doing it.
I think good segue actually into going down a level. Sheila asked a while ago, and I'm just going to scroll back up to make sure I get Sheila's wording correctly. Sheila said, I'm concerned that the global effort will not be done with a strong unified force. This is in terms of poverty eradication, I think. The UK has slashed its foreign aid budget, and we know where the USA has not been. How to unify countries that are resource full. I'm going to offer a slight reframing on that and say, kind of the danger of only relying on wealthy countries to solve global ills. Because one of the times in history that the wealthiest nations in the world have gotten together was in the early 20th century to carve up Africa into colonial states and create very unnatural borders that divided, existing nations and people and served as extractive bases for the capitalist economies of Europe.
And set the stage for an AIDS pandemic.
Yes, well as many other crises. So I think there's a question there, is a strong unified force of the wealthy countries a desirable one? And if it could be desirable, then how would that happen? And like I said, huge question. We don't have time for it, but any thoughts of yours?
okay, I'm going to follow this so closely. And I'm a small person, but I'm going to scream really loud when the time comes. There in one of my slides, and I can't remember the acronym, I talk about the United Nations World Health Organization group that's been pulled together to make sure that the vaccines are rolled out in resource poor countries. So that's good. We have an international committee that's going to keep an eye on that. I think what we need to understand about this deadly virus, if your compassion as a human being does not inspire you to make sure everyone receives the immunization, then what you must think about is if you leave people unvaccinated, mass populations unvaccinated, the world will not be a safe place. You cannot travel. You will always be stamping out infections and outbreaks because you don't have the whole world vaccinated. And the risk in that is that if you keep a population with this simmering COVID-19 infection and mutations happen, and that mutation makes it to a vaccinated population, you're starting all over again. You have a more virulent, more dangerous virus, and now you have to create a new vaccine. So if that doesn't make people focus on getting everyone immunized, I don't know what will. I'm terrified if we don't get everyone immunized, both from a compassionate point of view, what does that mean about us as human beings? And from a more selfish point of view, oh my God, I don't want to live with a horrifying virus because we neglected massive groups of people.
Okay. I think let's, again, you offered the perfect segue to go down to more national and local discussions. People are always going to be worried about civil liberties, I think, with a rollout of a vaccine that potentially might not be equitable, potentially could lead to additional barriers of access. For example, people are talking about, or Christine Elliott, Minister of Health, actually said that there could be a requirement to show a record of vaccination to enter certain public spaces. At the same time, the vaccine distribution is being taken on by the Canadian military, and people are worried about, is that setting the stage for a military occupying force in case of widespread social dissent? Any thoughts on any of those situations as they unfold, and how we could best do vaccine rollout to avoid those problems?
Yeah, they're pretty scary.
Ran out of time again, that's all. Thanks as always to our guests and to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gavert, Hina Mystery, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us in one of our live Zoom sessions, or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. If you'd like to support the work that we do on this program, please visit patreon.com and look for Breezy Bullhorn. Thank you for any support you can lend, and as always, for listening.